Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 28, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Norman Day, who, and the session number is DAN 2001-2. The title of his presentation is Environmental Concerns at the Holden Mine. Let's listen in to Norman.
And some of you already know who I am, but I'm Norm Day. I work for the Forest Service out of Wenatchee, and I'm the project manager for the cleanup project over here that's been taking up quite a bit of time. And if you saw the first segment of the presentations I'm giving, it was kind of a history from discovery of the Holden Mine, the ore body, up to the time the deposit, the mine shut down. And this presentation is going to kind of, there'll be a few years lapse in there, but it basically will take you from the early days after the Holden Village was established, and it shows you some of the earlier work we did out here to remediate the site or reclaim the site. And then I'm going to follow up with a kind of an overview of our current effort at completing the job of cleaning up the site. Most of you already know where you're at. You're at Holden Village.
Sometimes, I'm not sure.
But in case you're not, we're right there, 12 miles up River Creek from Lake Chelan, and we're surrounded by the Glacier Creek Wilderness. The Howe Sound Mining Company operated the mine from 1937 to 1957. And the mill, which is located right here, and the mine, the ore body is up here on the hillside, trends through the area like this, and all the ore, well, this is before the waste dumps were up in here even, but the main portal was right over in here, and that's where all the ore came out. The mine and mill produced about $70 million from copper, zinc, and gold, and silver. Today, if you were to calculate the value of, this would be gross value, the value of minerals produced in today's metals prices would be about $330 million. During the operation, about 57 miles of underground workings were constructed in the hillside, and this is kind of a cross-section, illustrative or diagrammatic cross-section, not a lot of detail in it to show you how the ore body was mined, but this area right in here represents the ore zone, and it was steeply dipping to the southwest, and it averaged between 75 to 100 feet thick. And the ore body contained primarily copper with zinc, and then lesser amounts of gold and silver. The mine started off, this is the 1500 level, or what they call the third level now, if you were to hike up to the top of the waste dumps where the mine portal is. The village calls that the third level, but it was the 1500 level in the mine. And it's the way they identify their levels in the mine is the discovery point is the zero point. And this is where the ore body crops out on the surface way up on the hillside. And everything was measured down from that point. So the 1500 level right here is 1500 feet down from that zero point on the hillside. And I think if you were to look at elevations, we're about 3,400 feet, 3,300 feet, something like that right here, or right up at the 1500 level. The upper part of the ore body here was, most of this was mined in the early years of the mine up through World War II. A lot of the ore, a good portion of the ore was used in the war effort, so there was some value to that effort from this particular mine. There was a shaft it's not shown on this diagram, but there was a shaft that connected all these upper workings, and that's what they used to haul men and equipment to the upper levels. The ore, they used gravity to bring the ore down to this level where they loaded it in ore cars. And they had some huge rooms in here because the ore body was so thick, and the rock on either sides of it were so confident they were able to use stoping, and they mined out these huge rooms of ore. And some of them are, you know, 75 to 100 feet in thick and in width, up to maybe 500 feet in length, and some of them were up to 500 feet in height. Just huge caverns inside the mountain. And by the end of World War II, they had mined most of this ore body out.
Was that a hull then?
A lot of it is, yeah. I mean, it's not exactly one large cavern, but there's a series. You know, they would, when they were developing the ore body, they would drill into this area to determine where the ore grade zones were. They had a certain cutoff point, and they would only run certain quality of ore through the mill. That doesn't mean to say that there wasn't mineralized, the other rock that they didn't run through the mill was mineralized, but just didn't contain high enough content to be run. So it wasn't one huge room the entire length of the ore body, which is about 3,000 feet in length. They did mine, these stopes are within 30 feet of the surface up at the upper levels, and one of the things that we are concerned about, at some point in time, the area here that might collapse and open up the upper part of the ore body to greater volume of water than what we have coming in right now through fractures. Then later on, after World War II, most of the mining was in the lower portions of the ore body. Here, they had to actually use the shaft not only to get men and equipment down, but this is where they also poured all the ore up to this point here. This was the number two shaft, and then out to the mill. And everything was run through the mill flotation process, and then loaded into trucks, all down to Lucerne, put on barges, barged down to Chelan, put on trucks, hauled to the rail yard there at Chelan, put on trains, and hauled to Tacoma, where it was smelted. About 8.5 million tons of tailings are on the surface. The National Forest System lands, and they cover about 90 acres. This is tailings pile one, tailings pile two, tailings pile three. This is Copper Creek. It comes down right here to, and this is of course the village. There are several other large waste dumps right here that are, this is the mine portal right now, and these waste dumps were developed outside of the portal. And then we have some waste dumps further up on the hillside where some of the earlier workings were. All together we have about 120 acres of disturbance. Of course, after the mine shut down, and a few years thereafter, the mining interests were deeded to the Lutheran Bible Institute, and then in 1962, Holden Village was incorporated. And of course, you know the story. Since then, they've been using the village as a non-denominational retreat, and they do that under a special use permit with the Forest Service, because the land here is National Forest System lands, but the buildings belong to Holden Village and the Lutheran Bible Institute. While up on the hillside, some of the mining claims up there are patented and are private land and belong solely to Holden Village and the Lutheran Bible Institute. So they still own the ore body, what's left of it. Maybe that was why they got a geologist involved, because they did have some mining interest. And for a while, Holden Village also had mining claims on the tailings, because the tailings still do contain some gold, and there was a thought of someday reprocessing those tailings to make a profit, but at today's price, you just couldn't do it. Anyway, since the early 60s, the Forest Service and other agencies, both federal and state, have kind of conducted a number of studies on impacts associated with the Holden mine and the tailings, and it was apparent that something needed to be done, particularly when water started coming out of the portal. That was very obvious. It took a few years, but eventually all those lower workings below the 1500 level filled up with water eventually. And sometime in the late 60s, early after I was here, I don't remember water coming out when I was here, but sometime in the late 60s, water started coming out of the portal. And did a number of studies and come up with plans for correcting some of the problems, but The Forest Service really never had the money to tackle something this large until the late 1980s, when through the Department of Agriculture, of course, the Forest Service is an agency in the Department of Agriculture, not Interior like some people may think. And throughout the U.S., we have a number of hazmat type sites, hazardous substances sites, where we have pollutions, you know, on USDA lands. And the Department of Agriculture established a special fund to help its various agencies clean up some of the worst of the worst sites. And so we managed to tap into some money in the late 80s, and we did kind of an interim action at the site. And the work started in 1989, and we were done by 91, 92. It was kind of a limited action. And kind of go over what we did. Prior to us doing any work, this was what we had out here. These wood logs here or cribbing were used when the tailings were originally put in to keep them in place. And over the years, they've rotted out, and you can see where Railroad Creek flows right along the edge of the tailings pile and is picking up the tailings. And then, of course, at high water, you even get more erosion of the tailings by Railroad Creek. So what we did during this interim action, we brought in riprap, or large boulders, and put them all along the toe of the tailings piles to keep this erosion down. In addition, prior to us coming out here and doing this work, in the spring when the snow melted, and you know, we get 350 to 400 inches of snow annually here, or on average, when that melts, we'd end up with these huge ponds on the surface. And that allowed more water to infiltrate into the tailings piles, and that increased the instability of the tailings piles and could have led to a mass failure where you could have lost a big chunk of the tailings on the toe, just slid right into Railroad Creek, or if you had an earthquake event, not necessarily a large earthquake event, but during the time these things were saturated, you could have kind of liquefied the tailings and would have slid right into Railroad Creek also. So what we did to try to correct that was to, we graded or recontoured the tops of these tailings piles, and then we put in channels, drainage channels on the top of them to try to get the water off as quick as we could in the spring. And then probably the biggest problem we had out here was the blowing tailings. When they finally did dry out, after these ponds dried out, the tailings, and we'd have the up and down valley winds you get here in the mountains, would pick up these tailings and just blow them all over, including the village. And for anyone that had respiratory problems, you just couldn't hardly breathe at that period of time. So what we did to solve that problem was we hit the wrong button, almost thought I was going to lose the picture. we brought in up to about 6 inches of gravel. We have a big gravel pit not too far down the road here, well, on top of the switchbacks. And we put 6 inches of tailings, or 6 inches of gravel over all these 90 acres of tailings. And
that's a lot of
that
gravel.
Stopped the gravel, that stopped the dust. And of course, then what we want to do is to also reestablish vegetation. And you can see we brought in woody debris and laid it on the gravel, and we created what we call soil islands or vegetation islands. And you can see some of these out here. Those were areas where we had a little more soil in the gravel, and we actually planted trees and shrubs there. And over the years, the 10 years since we've done this, the vegetation has naturally been spreading out, and we've got a lot of natural revegetation on top of these tailings piles. And you can kind of see here how this is turning out. These trees that you see right along the edge of the tailings piles have been there, they got established sometime and have been growing naturally. These larger trees you see, this is what was tailings pile one right here. And these trees here, there's a few trees, if you walk around up there, that are much larger than the trees we planted. And over the years, in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, there have been a number of research projects on trying to get vegetation reestablished up here. And they did get some trees, but it was really hard. They had to irrigate those suckers like crazy to get them to grow. Because when it dried out, when these tailings dried out, it was just like a desert up there. You couldn't get vegetation. If you ever got it started, it just wouldn't, unless you watered it, it wouldn't go. But the gravel was the secret. It's allowed the vegetation enough time to get roots down into the tailings piles, and it's really, really working quite nicely. We even get a pretty good crop of grass for a while until it dries out. This is kind of a before and after shot. This is taken from up on the third level at the waste dump outside the portal. I haven't talked much about the mill building, what's left, but you remember seeing the pictures at the beginning of the slide. This is all that's left, is a concrete foundation and a bunch of metal up here, which poses a pretty significant safety problem. The company has come out now last year and put a chain link fence around the whole area keep people out.
Darn.
Anyway, even though we improved the site conditions significantly, and we spent $3.2 million doing it, of your federal tax dollars, we hadn't solved all the threats to human health and the environment. And the problems that still exist, well, by the way, this is what the portal looked like up until last year. I don't know if you've been up there looking at it now. It doesn't look like it is now.
It's an air conditioning duct.
It's an air conditioning duct. It was caved in here. This first 90 feet of the 1500 level portal went through glacial till, and over the years it just collapsed. It just rotted out the wood timbers and collapsed. And there was a little air blowing through there, but not much. But there was water flowing through it, didn't you? Came out the portal and then went down the drainage ditch and then flows right into Railroad Creek. The white color here is a aluminum precipitate, and it's kind of interesting, depending on how the pH of the water changes, you either get this white milky aluminum precipitate or you'll get an orangish precipitate, which is iron, and it's based upon the pH, which is what happens to be precipitating based on that pH of the water.
There's a big, big hose thing coming out.
That if you could, let's see.
Has water coming out.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if I have any good pictures showing what that, but that connects right in to the water that's coming out of the mine. We have a bulkhead in there and have water dammed up behind it, which is another story. That's just to control the water flowing out, because we have some instruments in there that are continually recording the water level and stuff like that. And I think I have some pictures for a later presentation if you're around for that. But anyway, the biggest problem that we weren't able to resolve is that we do have leaching or movement of contaminants from the mine, the portals, the waste dumps, the maintenance area, tailings piles that degrade water quality. They're carrying heavy metals, or they're have acidic conditions that carry a lot of iron that are impacting the fisheries.
So are the fish safe to eat?
Yes, the fish are safe to eat if you can find them. At least right out here. But yeah. And then we also have cementation or solidification of the creek bed. And of course that's reducing the aquatic habitat. It prohibits the macroinvertebrates, little critters that the fish eat, so you don't find very many fish in this stretch. There will be fish in here, and they're just really going between the good areas where they can find something to eat.
Just passing through.
But you can see right here the orangish color. This is one of the more significant seeps coming from underneath tailings pile one. And when the water comes out there, it carries a lot of iron, and it hits the pH starts going up. It's real acidic, and then the pH starts raising, and it drops out the iron. And you can see it here in the creek, and it's so much iron is coming out that it's actually solidified and cemented the gravel. So it looks just like concrete in places. You can walk along the River Creek from the footbridge, walk down toward this point, and you can see, if you get right up to the creek, you can see places where it's probably a foot to 18 inches thick.
Wow.
Just like concrete. And this is what's happening right here. It's forming right in here. The area further up by the footbridge, it's not forming there anymore. And of course, there's still a potential for mass failure in the tailings pile. Even though that riprap is doing its job for erosion, there's still a potential for mass failure. And this is tailings pile 2, and that's 120 feet high above the creek, and it's right on the creek. So, in the Anyway, about 1995. We through some litigation in Idaho with a mining cleanup project in Idaho, we discovered who the successor company was to Howe Sound. To this point in time, we didn't know. We've been trying to find out, but we just couldn't find the right tracks. And
no one stepped up and just...
No one volunteered. No,
I mean, it's
responsible
as
most corporate Americans.
Anyway, in 95 we found out who this was, and then we started some preliminary discussions with the company, and by early 1997 we were pretty seriously engaged with the company that was liable under the Superfund Act. And we call that and I'm going to start using now, as you can see, a lot of acronyms, and I'll try to explain them as I go along. One of the problems I had was getting everything onto one slide if I didn't use acronyms. But in early 97, we started this negotiation process. The Forest Service, EPA, and the Washington Department of Ecology were cooperating agencies, and we began these discussions with the PRP, which is a potentially responsible party. And in this case, the company is called Intalco. And actually, there's been a couple other names before them, but their current corporate name is Intalco. And they are owned, and I'm not sure exactly how the relationship is, but Alcoa Aluminum owns them, and is a partial owner, and then a large company, or industrial company over in France called Pechenet. They have the corporate ownership of Intalco, but Intalco is the company we're dealing with. And this cleanup is being done under CERCLA, which is also an acronym for the Superfund Act. You probably heard of the Superfund Act. And then MATCA is the Washington State equivalent to CERCLA, and that's the Model Toxics Control Act. So we're doing this, our authority to conduct this discussion and negotiation with the PRP was through the Federal Superfund Act and the State Model Toxics Control Act. On April 11th, 1998, the three agencies completed our negotiation and entered into an administrator order on consent, or an AOC. That's a legal documents filed with the court. And that directs Intalco to perform a detailed study of the site, and then to do a feasibility study of various alternatives for cleaning the site up. And this legal agreement then has the three agencies governing or directing this cleanup study. The Forest Service is the lead agency, and for what I call the RIFS, and that's the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study. And there's actually two big documents that have come out of this. The Remedial Investigation is the site characterization. And this is where we collect a lot of environmental data to determine exactly what the impacts are at the site. And then once we have that done, then we move into the feasibility study where we evaluate technologies and put these different technologies together in alternatives and then analyze those in detail to arrive at the preferred cleanup remedy. Let's see. We're also, in addition to the cleanup study, or the RIFS, we're also doing NRDA, or National Resource Damage Assessment. And typically, and we're doing that in conjunction with the RIFS, so the remedial investigation. And the Forest Service is the lead trustee. Other trustees are the state of Washington, the Yakima Nation, Indian Nation, the Colville Indian Nation are all natural resource trustees in this action. But we're doing these two actions together. Typically on big projects like this, they do them separately. But because they're not, you end up with a little different product. When you do a cleanup, you just clean up the problems of delivering the hazardous substances to the environment. When you do the natural resource damage, you're trying to restore the habitat or to at least get compensation for damages done to the resources. So we're trying to do this all in one study. We'll see how successful we are when we get done. But anyway, the Holden Mine Project is the largest mine cleanup project in the Pacific Northwest region of the Forest Service. And a couple years ago, we reached a settlement with Intalco for recovery of $3.1 million of our past costs spent on this project. And we spent $3.2 million on the original interim action we did, and then in the years since then, we've been monitoring the site, and we have a salary of our employees and consultants we've had help us monitoring. So when we started negotiations with Intalco, this was a separate negotiation to the one on the AOC. The AOC was just related to them doing the study. This agreement, this settlement, which was documented in a consent decree, called for Intalco to, and we originally billed them $6.2 million. That was our starting point. And we finally, they negotiated it down, we negotiated it up, and we agreed to 3.1. That may seem like maybe the federal government, and of course we had Department of Justice help representing us in this, it may seem like we gave up too much, but in reality we got quite a bit out of this besides the $3.1 million, which we could use elsewhere for cleanup projects around in the Forest Service. We got the company to relieve the Forest Service from any future liability at this site. They also agreed in principle to perform the remedy when we get to that point. Now, once we complete the RIFS, that's when the administrative order we currently have with them expires, and we'll have to negotiate another administrative order or consent decree to get with the company to actually do the cleanup. But in the negotiations over past costs, they've already agreed that they're going to do the remedy. Hopefully that will save in negotiation time. But anyway, over the past 3 years, Intalco and their consultants, initially they had Daines & Moore as their consultant, and then recently Daines & Moore was acquired by another company called URS. It's the same people were doing the work, just have a different name now, instead of Daines & Moore. But they collected a lot of environmental data characterizing the contaminations at the site and assessing injury to the natural resources. They've produced a draft remedial investigation report, or RI report, and actually we have a copy up here in the resource room if you're interested. It's only about so thick, there are several volumes to it, but if you're interested in some, aren't sleeping at night. We're still going through review. I mean, this document's now, well, we've had it in our hands for about almost 2 years, and we actually had to have them submit us a whole new document. And, you know, it's kind of a negotiation process. We they do the document and we comment on it, and then they address our comments and back and forth. And we're hoping by the end of the summer we will have reached final agreement and can say that we can close the door on the remedial investigation report. Anyway, some of the key findings from the RI is that we have seasonal exceedances of water quality at various places, but all the way from the mine site all the way down to Lake Chelan. And this, but it's seasonal. It's not continuous year-round. And the primary metals that we have problems with are copper, zinc, and cadmium. I mean, there are other metals that that will exceed iron. We have a lot of iron, but there's not an iron standard. So those are the primary ones. We've had a reduction in benthic macroinvertebrates and fish populations within the mine site, from just above the vehicle bridge down maybe about a mile or so beyond the last tailings piles. We've done fish shocking and stuff like that, and there is a reduction in fish in this stretch. The tailings piles are still unstable, and the soils up in the maintenance yard where the shop and that area are, and then also in a lagoon area alongside the road that goes up to the maintenance yard, those soils are contaminated and exceed the Model Toxics Control Act standards. And then we found that there's some nearshore sediments down at Lucerne, where River Creek flows in, that are contaminated with zinc, just barely above the state freshwater quality criteria. And we're going to have the company, maybe this year, but for sure next year, do some bioassays on in that area. Yes.
What was the maintenance yard? What does it exceed? The same things you were talking about, zinc, copper.
Some of the same metals, and there. I think there's some problems with hydrocarbons in that area as well, which may not be related. Well, I mean, that was a maintenance yard even when the mill was here, so I'm not sure if that was, you know, that particular, the hydrocarbons, and we're not sure if that's a Holden Village contribution or it was a contribution from the mining days.
Did they use arsenic to extract any of the metals?
No. There's very little arsenic in the deposit. There's very little lead in the deposit. There was some galena, which is a lead sulfide. You could, but they never recovered. Lead was not one of the minerals they recovered. And while we can find lead in our water quality samples, it doesn't violate any of the criteria, so it's pretty low. And same with arsenic. They did use cyanide for a brief time in the milling process, but it didn't work, and so they discontinued cyanide. Cyanide breaks down very rapidly in the environment, and we haven't found any evidence of cyanide in the tailings or anything else. Did that answer your question? And if any of you are interested in the exact levels of metals and all the metals, the draft RI in there would be your source, because I don't have them up here.
That's good. I guess one question I did have is, I know there's different bacteria that live on iron.
Yes.
And do you have a problem with a large bacterial population like that here?
I haven't noticed much out here, but we have some real interesting bacteria in the mine. Matter of fact, I don't think you'll see in this presentation some of the pictures from inside, very many pictures from inside the mine, but we have a real interesting bacteria that I call scum that lives on this sulfide rich water, and I've only seen it on the water, but it looks like soap suds, and it gets big mounds of like soap suds growing inside the mine.
So do you know about even harm from any of that bacteria?
I do not, and I'm not sure that the company's really looked at that. We've been in the mine on numerous occasions, and we haven't experienced any kind of health problems from it.
Yes.
Except I did have hair, though.
You've got a lawsuit right there.
Yeah, I know.
There you go.
Anyway, and In October of 1999, the Forest Service, EPA, and Department of Ecology, we sponsored a kind of a neat acid rock drainage workshop, and this has nothing to do with the kind of music you were talking about. Acid rock or acid mine drainage is kind of a field that's developed with a lot of these abandoned mines that were what we call massive sulfide mines, where the metals were found in sulfide type minerals. And when you expose these minerals or sulfide rich deposits to oxygen and water, you end up with dilute sulfuric acid, which continues the process of absorbing minerals in the deposit. So, and then the bacteria, you have sulfide eating bacteria that also contributes to the acid mine drainage problem, which is kind of an interesting thing once you get it, get this whole cycle going. But anyway, we have a lot of these mine sites around the country and the world, and we decided to have a workshop here on that subject. I mean, there are workshops probably at least one or two every year somewhere around the country on dealing with these sorts of environmental problems and how to solve them. And so we thought we'd have one right here and bring in experts at no cost. I mean, we couldn't pay them, but we figured that the advantage of having a workshop like that here, if we could get people to come, this is like the old movie about the ball field and would anyone come, is that we had the mine site right next to the classroom. And as it turned out, it was excellent. We got people, experts to come from around the country and Canada. We even had some people from England come over for this. And it was a week-long conference here. We had lectures here in this room right here and next door. And we would talk about some of the problems. Then we'd go out and stomp on the ground, kick some rocks, and look at the problem, come back in and talk about it some more. And it was really... really neat. We're thinking about doing it again after when we get to the point of having a preferred, or close to having a preferred remedy, and kind of ground truth about our work. Currently, even though we haven't quite finished the remedial investigation report, in other words, we don't have a final RI, we're in the early stages of the feasibility, and they kind of overlap one another, of the feasibility study, or FS, and that, of course, document will document the cleanup remedies and evaluate the potential alternatives and our natural resource restoration options. And just a few months ago, the agencies, the three agencies, reached an agreement with Intalco on the alternatives that will be continued through this process. And we've been debating on what those should be for maybe 6 months or more, and even longer when you look at some of the technologies that include in that. And we've come up with six action alternatives and one no action alternative, and you kind of always have a no action alternative. These alternatives are kind of based on general themes. So, you know, one alternative or a couple of the alternatives are going to look at how to control the water or water management as a way to clean up the site. Others will look at water treatment, concentrate on treating the water, and others will look at consolidating all of the contaminated material into one big pile. And in a little bit, I'm going to go through those alternatives in more detail, but for right now, I just want to set that off kind of in front of you, and then we'll get back to it in a second. Anyway, last summer, as part of the feasibility study, we had Intalco re-enter the collapsed 1500 level for purposes of assessing conditions within the mine workings that will help us evaluate various proposed technologies for managing and treating water. And without being into the mine, we weren't sure exactly what we'd find, but we felt that we might be able to find water, different sources of water, that hopefully some sources of water inside the mine may not be contaminated yet. Maybe we can divert that water so it didn't mix with the contaminated water and take it directly out of the mine so we wouldn't have to treat it. Maybe there's ways we could treat the water inside the mine before it ever came out. Also, if we, no matter what kind of water treatment plant we, or water treatment system we have here to clean up the water, they work best if you have a steady flow of water through them and don't go up and down in volume. And we get tremendous, a tremendous snowmelt flush to the mine in the spring, and then it gradually drops off through the rest of the year. And we thought maybe we can use the mine as a big storage tank and allow water to be stored in the mine during the wet season and then regulate it out through the mine the rest of the year, so we have a steady flow through whatever system we use for cleaning the water. And the debate that we're having between the agencies and the company is whether it's better to put watertight bulkheads in at the 1500 level and allow the water to fill up in the mine, a couple hundred feet. It wouldn't fill up enough to come out the next level, which is 1,000 foot. But anyway, there's a lot of storage space inside the mountain when you got 57 miles of underground work. Anyway, or the other part of that is to the water or the mine is flooded from up to the 1500 level. So the other option is to dewater part of the mine and then allow it to fill up during the rainy season and siphon down during the dry season. So we're still debating with the companies which way to go. So we needed to get into the mine. And this was our effort at doing it. This first segment of the mine was, collapsed with the glacial till and had collapsed over the years. And so we had to dig this all out and put in a new mine tunnel through that first part. We completely had to remove the old debris, the old timbers, and put new ones in. So this is kind of what it looked like last year before we started. Since it had been collapsed for so many years and there's water coming out, we figured that it was probably dammed up. The water was probably dammed up. We did not want the company to just start digging away and having a massive flood come down and engulf Holden Village and the new shop and everything else. So we first had to dewater that area. And what we did, we went up here above the mine, or up above the portal, and went in on created a little mine added ourselves, went in about 40 feet and then went straight down with the idea of coming into the mine beyond or right at the interface between the glacial till and the bedrock, mm-hmm. and then put pumps in. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. Once we finally dewatered, if you're here for my next segment, you'll see the whole, tomorrow, you'll see the whole process of what we did last summer. It's quite interesting. At least I think. But anyway,
was the water dammed up back?
Yeah, there? It was dammed up. Yeah, and so we pumped for several days before we started dismantling the old portal.
At this point, is Intalco paying for?
Yes, they're doing it all. I should mention, and I forgot to when I was talking about the settlement of the $3.1 million. Not only did they, they're in addition to that, they're paying. For their consultants, the Forest Service and EPA and Ecology, we have a consulting firm working for us, helping us do oversight of their work. And Intalco is paying for our consultant, they're paying for all of the Forest Service, EPA, and Ecology people that are working on this project. So
they're paying your salary.
Yes, right. Your tax dollars are not at work today. So, really, that's a pretty good deal, I think. I'm expensive. But not as expensive as our consultant, so. Anyway, this is what we saw when we first got into that hole and looked on the other side of the cave. This is right at that interface I was telling you about. And you can see mine timbers and pretty yucky water here. You can also see all these lines here, these are like in a bathtub, they're rings, dirty water rings. So at times the water essentially fills in this whole area in the spring, back up behind this plugged area. And so we pumped it down, this is about 10 feet high here off the floor. So At the time we came in here, there was at least 6 feet of water, and we pumped it down about 3 feet before we started working on the portal. And we just ran that dirty water right into the stream channel, and then instead of letting it go into River Creek, we diverted it, ran it down the drainage ditch in the road, and put it into that, what we call the lagoon area, and we can now see some real interesting mud cracks in the bottom. That's some of the precipitate that came out of the mine. That's where we diverted the water to, so we could settle out all this mud before it went into River Creek. So this is the first view into the mine in 30, 40 years. And you can see in this picture here, over the years, these mine timbers had rotted, and you see the big boulder laying right here. This is a glacial boulder, and between the rotten timbers and the weight of this glacial debris, it just collapsed. And it was like this all the way in. The whole 90 feet was like this. And we had little places here, you know, on the side where water kind of came out, but it was like this the whole way. So they replaced all the wood timbers now with steel sets. Instead of timber sets, they used steel. It was actually steel and then wood. You can see the wood lagging here on the sides. Working in driving this in, this was quite an interesting process that you'll hear more about tomorrow if you're around, but because of them working with this debris ahead of them, you know, they couldn't dig the entire tunnel out. They had to eventually, once you got a high wall too high, then they had to start going in, and they would advance this adit by 5 feet every day. If they were lucky, they could get 5 feet a day, and they'd drive these metal what they call spiling. They're about 14 foot long or metal. Some cases they used railroad track, and they brought in this special metal. And then they sharpen it and they drive it in with their air drill ahead of where they were going to be working to provide the ground support. And they go in. And you also see they had to support the working face to keep it from coming out at them. Then they would go in and remove this debris and put the next set in. And they did this day after day after day. And very dangerous work. I mean, these guys were very competent miners. I mean, we're lucky we had a good crew like this, or that it could have been a major accident. But you can see some of the big boulders. This was too heavy for them to even haul out the bucket of this loader, so they had to drag it out. And we had, you know, a lot of boulders like this.
And the guys doing this work are Intelco employees?
No, the people doing this work were from Atlas Fawcett Mining Company. They were contract miners contracted out to URS, who was... Once we finally completed the tunnel, repairing the tunnel and replaced it with the new material, we got to, again, right where that other picture was taken. But by this time, we'd left a mound of the collapsed debris about 3 feet high. We didn't want to remove that until we had finished the tunnel. And after we had dewatered more of the mine, we discovered that, well, it wasn't just dirty water, it was slime. It was precipitate 3 to 4 feet deep, and we didn't know how far this stuff went back in the mine, and we did not have the equipment there to deal with this. And so a couple of the miners decided the only way they could find out was to walk back in there and see how far this stuff went. So they downed their slickers and started walking, and this guy right here, even though it looks like he's standing on the floor, this stuff has enough consistency that he's actually suspended above the floor.
Oh, wow.
And the guy above, beyond him here, is walking on one of these timbers out there. That's why he's much higher. We found out that we also discovered that after we got in a ways, they had removed the rail, they had salvaged the track, but they left the mine, the railroad ties. And over the years, as this thing had flooded, you know, it's 1,800 feet back to the ore body. Over the years, you've gotten
logs.
These, all these railroad ties have come together, and you have a series of log jams all the way back in there, mixed with this 3 to 4 feet of iron precipitate or slime. And they walked about 50, 60 feet back in. It was just too dangerous for them to go any further, because once one in between the logs, they could get their legs stuck. And anyway, it was not safe, so they came back. And this picture, by the way, there was an article in the Wenatchee World on the cleanup project last fall. Anyway, it made the front page of the Wenatchee World.
So did they get all this stuff out eventually?
Just wait. Anyway, they had to bring in reinforcements, so they brought in this big what they call LHD, low-haul dump piece of equipment. They had a 2-yard bucket, and they just went in there and
could have
scraped everything up. Pardon?
And it looks like you're barely, it can have, well, there's no turning around, that's for sure.
No, you go in, you come back down backwards. Yeah. Well, anyway, there's a lot more to this story that you could hear tomorrow if you're here, but I don't, it's really intriguing and a lot of good work. Anyway, we finally made it in, and you can see us here. This was last November. It took from August to November to do this. We got in there in November for our first round of sampling water in that new mine. So this is a view of us. You can see one, there's an intersection of two drifts here on the 1500 level, one going this way, one going this way. And here are some of the consultants in there sampling. You can see that the slime is everywhere. Matter of fact, I've dedicated my mine clothes to just the mine. And when you come back from there, you don't wash them at home in your lawn, in your laundry, or your washing machine, you take it to the laundromat. Let someone else deal with your problems.
That's why all those laundromat machines are always broken.
Here's some of this scum that I was telling you about, this bacterial growth that we have in here. Also, while we were in there, we got back to the number 2 shaft that goes down another 1,000 feet, and we sent instruments down there to record from the water quality, and to take, actually, this is a sampling device, and we sent it down, and it would actually go down to the preset depth, and then it would take the things would close on it, and it would take a water sample and bring up and get analyze the water at depth in that shaft. Anyway, then we restored the portal, and we asked the miners if they could try to make it look like it looked before. So they dressed it up a little bit with some of the old wood timbers and put some old rusty shovels and pickaxes. That's yours truly standing there. This is the pipe that comes out and it connects in with the first bulkhead that camps. You know, it's 900 feet in. And there's metal doors, locking doors on that now. And the wind, this mine breathes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like a cave. And the wind pulling out of there pretty good.
Pretty cold.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to run probably right up to time for dinner here, but these are again the summary of the alternatives that we're looking at, and basically the no action alternative doesn't do much other than put some bad gates and other access restrictions on some of the workings further up the mine. The next alternative deals with trying with water management and by collecting water as it comes down the hillside, putting big trenches in up here to collect the water and to run it off before it comes in contact with the tailings piles, and then also improving the drainage on the top of the tailings pile. Well, we do some excavation of the contaminated soils here in the lagoon, and then also with all the contaminated soils in the mill building and the maintenance yard. And that's about it. We don't think this alternative will meet the water quality criteria when we get done. This alternative adds some water treatment to the west side of the site and collects the seeps coming from the waste dumps. And then there's some seeps over here along here that will collect and run it through a water treatment system of some kind, at least a wetlands or passive water treatment system. The next alternative is treating of just the seeps from the tailings pond or tailings piles, collecting that, those seeps, and treating. The next alternative combines treatment in both east and west sides. We're treating all of the contaminated water. It also calls for relocating Railroad Creek here so we can put in a larger wetlands system. Originally, Railroad Creek flowed right down through here before they ever put the tailings piles in.
So they put the tailings on top of the creek.
So, well, they moved the creek over and then put them there, yeah. The next alternative is somewhat similar to the previous one, but instead they added a capping. We would put some kind of impermeable cap over the tailings piles, over the waste dumps, and then also in the mill area. This would eliminate the infiltration. Alternative 7 is a pretty aggressive one, and it actually calls for consolidating all the tailings piles and waste dumps into one big pile.
Yeah. Oh man.
That would take a lot of work and be the most disruptive to the village's operations. But at least you'd have everything in one big pile, and there's some advantages to it, but then there's some disadvantages too. So this is kind of what our schedule looks like right now, and it is a flexible schedule that changes every 6 months, it seems like. But hopefully we'll have the final remedial investigation report approved by the agencies this fall. We'll get a draft feasibility study sometime this winter, and maybe if we're lucky, we'll finalize it next fall. If we do that, then we'll have what they call a proposed plan, and the company does up to this point. They will complete the final feasibility study. At that point, they're out of the picture, and the agencies then take their information, and we come up with a proposed plan, what remedy the agencies are going to select. And that is then released to the public formally for public comment as a proposed plan. Then we take comment from both the public and the company and produce the record of decision for whatever the remedy is going to be. Then we have to negotiate a consent decree with the company to actually do the cleanup. Then, once we get that done, the company will do a final engineering design, which is right here, and then if we're lucky, we may begin construction in 2004.
Wow.
And depending on how aggressive the remedy is, it can take from 2 to 3 year construction period.
Wow.
And that's it. And if anyone is interested in getting some information on the site and getting some of these digital pictures and other information, you can tune in on our website and go under Hot Topics and look for the site. So, we have a little bit of time before lunch, even though this is supposed to technically end right now, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I know it's early, but is there any, do you know which of those plans is you're leaning towards, or which is most feasible, or?
Well, the company, and I don't blame them, they want to do the least expensive one. And the agencies are not necessarily trying to come up with the most expensive one, but we want to be sure that the remedy meets water quality criteria. He gets the water treated to an acceptable level, and preferably that meets the water quality requirements here in the state. And that's going to be a big chore. And we also want the remedy to be a permanent fix, and not have to come back in a few years and do something different. And we would like to have it be a low maintenance system, because this essentially, whatever we do is going to be forever. At least until maybe, you know, maybe 30, 40 years down the road, when new technologies may make something else applicable here that could maybe create or correct the problem without the treatment plan. But we believe the agencies, now I'm speaking for the agencies, not the company now, but the agencies believe that we will need some sort of water treatment system beyond just the passive or wetlands type environment. We think that they will actually need to treat the water with a regular chemical treatment plant of some kind. Now we would like, I think the agencies would like to believe we could do it through a passive system of wetlands, where we have an aerobic and an anaerobic type wetlands environment that will remove the water, but we don't believe that process, unless the company can demonstrate it to us, will get the water quality results we want. And as far as consolidating the tailings piles, well, we do have some pretty, the worst metal loading we have for Railroad Creek occurs in those seeps under tailings pile one, where I showed you the red water running out. There's some merit maybe to moving tailings pile one and getting it out of the way so we can correct that problem. There's some merit to doing something with some of the waste dumps. We're getting some pretty nasty contamination coming out of there, but maybe it'd be more efficient to just cap it and cut the water off from above. I don't know. We have a lot of work to do yet analyzing, the company does, and analyzing the alternatives, and they're going to try to, if we go with a low end type alternative, the company is going to have to demonstrate to the agencies and the public that it will work. We'll see where that all goes. And right now we don't have any kind of cost estimates for any of these. The company might put some general cost estimates together, but until you get further down the line, it's really premature to speculate on what the remedies are going to cost.
Is that just turned into the Holden Village dump site up there?
No.
I've noticed
no, they've got, they salvage a lot of dump, yeah.
Stuff up there.
It's a lot of that scrap metal that if they were anywhere else, they could take to a dump somewhere. They might even be able to get some kind of a salvage price for it, but they're so far away that it's not economical. And it would be good to have someone from Holden Village here that could address that question, but it's...
I noticed
they haul stuff out periodically.
Toilets
when they can.
And appliances and all kinds of junk up there.
Yeah. That area up there, that's not National Forest. There's an area up there by the mill buildings. There's about 10 acres there that are patented. And so they're storing that stuff on their private land.
That's the question I had. I'm forever getting confused on what Holden owns and what is Forest Service. Can you go through that?
Well, we own the worst of it. Oops, maybe I should. Can you see this enough back there?
From up here, yes.
The ore body is up here on the hillside. Wait a minute. I think I got it.
You had that on the.
Yeah, I got another slide here. I forgot that I do some arm waving with from time to time.
Forgot.
Okay, the ore body's up here on the hillside, and there's a number of patented mining claims. In other words, the claims that contain the ore body were patented and became private property. Those are owned 50-50 by Lutheran Bible Institute and Holden Village, Inc. So that's a lot of this area up here. It's private. It goes across Railroad Creek, and just a corner of it comes in by the ballpark.
Okay.
Okay, then this is where the mill building sits, and there's 10 acres in here, and I don't know exactly where the boundary is up in here, but the new maintenance shop is right on the boundary. Okay? I mean, on private land, and if you just pass that, the downhill edge of the shop, you're on National Forest. So this area in here is basically Holden Village, and I'm assuming that's the area where they put their refuse up there or their salvage material, because I don't think they would be able to do that under the Forest Service Special Use Permit. Okay, so all the tailings and part of these waste dumps are on National Forest. The portal is on National Forest, and then there's another portal over here called the ventilator portal that I didn't show you pictures of, but it's where when the mine was operating, they had a big fan sitting there to provide ventilation for the mine. And that's caved or collapsed as well. So the majority of this is National Forest System lands.
So the Howe Sound Mining Company was depositing their tailings on Forest Service land.
Yeah, and they did that with our permission. I mean,
with your permission. Yeah. Oh, they did. Okay.
Not that we would have, not that we had a lot of choice in the matter. I mean, there's some. You know, we had some room to negotiate with them, but. In those days, we didn't have the current regulations we have now for mining operations, and we, of course today we would have done things differently anyway. I mean, we still may have ended up with the tailings there, but we would have had impermeable liners underneath the tailings piles, and things would have been.
How long did they landfill?
See, they did pump about 1.5 million tons of tailings back into the mine. And backfilled some of the stopes on the lower levels.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So does Holden own the mineral rights to the ore bodies?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, they own the private land and what they own the private land and all, you know, title, all.
What about the buildings like this and the hotel?
They own the buildings, but they're on the National Forest. Okay. That's why the special use permit for the village, the operation of the village. Okay. Even though the buildings are belong to Holden Village, they can only remain here under the special use permit.
Okay, so that's why they can't build any new buildings here or do a whole lot.
Well, they could build new buildings if the Forest Service were to allow it.
Okay.
But they even to remodel them, you have to go through the state historic preservation officer. And there's certain. And it seems kind of strange when the buildings really don't belong to the Forest Service, but that's the way we operate with anything that's occupying National Forest System lands.
There was a guy out watering the flowers, and we were talking this morning, and he was talking about some of the flowerings, and the National Forest Service has a problem with bringing in outside plants to plant in the area. So we were talking about that, and that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, a lot of these flowers look like daisies are really weeds
that
are noxious.
Right.
That's and they look like pretty flowers.
Yeah. And this guy was saying he was pulling them up because he said the National
I can't
Forest
tell
Service,
the difference myself.
Yeah, but, I couldn't either. And he said the National Forest Service would prefer that you just pull them up and they not be here at all. I'm like, but they're so pretty.
And we think that that a lot of those were brought in when Winston Townsite was here. People would bring them in, you know, and just plant them around their yards. And that's how they got established here to begin with.
So the Winston Town site is also on Forest Service.
Yeah,
Holden.
And that's right in here.
Yeah. So Holden actually does not own very much acreage.
No, they own the 10 acres up here, and then they probably own maybe 80 or 100 acres up here on the hillside where the ore deposit is.
Okay.
Somebody said they were negotiating maybe giving away the mineral rights.
Yes, that we have. See, Holden Village and Lutheran Bible Institute are really PRPs, like in Talco. Mm-hmm. They have contributed to the problem here. Besides innocently acquiring it, they did contribute back in the 70s, I think. They were using Tailings Pile 1 for their drain field. Mm-hmm. And there was a mass failure here in this tailings pile one. Quite a bit of tailings failed into Railroad Creek. And so Holden Village is a PRP, but we have not been, looking at Holden Village as contributing significant amounts of money to the cleanup. They have, you know, they will likely contribute something to the cleanup, and there will be a consent decree entered into between the agencies and Holden Village at some point in time. And what was your question exactly? You were asking about
just the amount of property.
The amount of property, and that. A part of that consent decree, that's what got me started on this, they will donate their mineral rights, maybe even the property rights themselves. Probably not the property rights, but the mineral rights, because...
the mineral rights should be worth a fair amount.
Well, not really. There was a little bit of ore left in the mine when it shut down, but boy, to get a mine started today in this type of an environment would be...
Depending on what technology does in the future.
There would be some kind of covenants placed on the deeds restricting mineral development. That's probably what would happen. And in the meantime, we've withdrawn this part of the area from the mineral law. We've withdrawn from mineral entries, so you cannot locate new mining claims here either. In a manner to protect whatever remedy we come up with.
Good. Yeah. Hmm.
So you know, if Holden Village will probably in the end provide maybe some staff to help monitor the remedy when it's, and that'll be their contribution.
Is Holden Village on the registry of the National Historic?
No. It's been, a report's been done, but it's never been formally submitted on up to the state, to SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Officer. We're working on a new report, Forest Service is, to incorporate whatever we do in the final remedy.
Couple questions.
Uh-huh.
One, has a three-dimensional model been made of the area, including the mine, the shafts, and locations? You've shown us two-dimensional cutaways, but has a three-dimensional model of all that been made?
Not yet. There is an old one that's up in the museum that was done, and it's too bad it's in such poor shape because it would really be a neat tool to demonstrate what they look like. We have asked the company, URS, to produce that, because the more we sample water inside the mine, we've discovered that it's really going to be handy to have that three-dimensional model. And it is their intent to produce that model. They haven't yet, but they're going to, and that's going to be really critical when we work our way through the feasibility study.
My second question, you addressed it a little bit because you said you wanted to come up with a plan that would be low maintenance and would mean that you wouldn't have to come back if something went wrong.
Right.
My mind says, okay, worst case scenario, something went wrong with the option you chose and what you went through, you completed it and it's not working. What then?
Then we do have the option of bringing the company back into it. I mean, if they didn't come in voluntarily, we might have to initiate a legal action. But there is always kind of an opener if things really go bad.
On the tailings piles, aren't you going to have to stabilize them just anyway? Because it
I'm sorry. A part of all the remedies involved, and I went over those very quickly because we just didn't have time. But all of them involve some recontouring of the edge of the tailings piles to improve the stability, and also we'll put in more riprap along the toe of the tailings piles as well.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Of the animals that live around here, you said there was less fish, and then you used some word that I had no idea what kind of...
Mackerel and burbot?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the critters they eat, the bugs and stuff.
So there's less of that, but do you know if there's been any, like, birth defects reported in the...
We haven't seen them yet. We've done a risk assessment, and the water and the tailings are not don't pose a risk to wildlife or humans, but they do to aquatic
fish and macrovertebrates.
Okay, so it affects the food chain, but it's not.
And it's not bioaccumulated.
Oh, okay, well that's good. I was the one that asked the question about the iron bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
So is this the only project you work on?
No, I'm going to be talking about it later in the week, but I'm working on a couple uranium mines in Oregon. And I'm working on a new project. I'm just starting dealing with contamination in the Lake Roosevelt area, which is the dam that's built up behind behind Grand Coulee.
Yeah. Why is this the biggest cleanup site? I have a hard time believing this little dinky mine up here was the worst.
I didn't say it was worst, it's the largest.
It's the largest.
Actually, it is the worst of those that we have, the Forest Service has, in Pacific Northwest.
Oh, so the other ones are privately held or something? They're just not.
Or other agencies, but this was the biggest mine in this area, though. I mean, in the Pacific Northwest.
This one also?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I'm gonna.
How is it? I mean, do you
leave this sit here and then go get lunch and come back and finish picking up?
do you look up to the Idaho area too?
No, just Washington and Oregon.